But I'm Lou, and I'm an alcoholic. Most of us know Father Martin mainly from chalk talk and from guidelines. And so I'd like to take just a moment before I give him the podium and mention a few items in his background. Father Martin was ordained priest for Archdiocese of Boston, May 1948. Has been involved in alcoholism since January 59. A graduate of Rutgers School of Alcohol Studies. Has lectured and provided consultancy services for the three branches of the military in the U.S., Europe, and Asia. Has lectured for state government alcohol programs and rehabilitation in all 50 states. At present, associate pastor of St. Joan of Arc Church in Aberdeen, Maryland. At a meeting of the advisory council about almost a year ago, we tried to figure out how we could best celebrate this very important 35th anniversary of AA in Oregon. We wanted a speaker who would draw a crowd, but more important, a person who would impart to us from the podium knowledge to assist us in our important work and to inspire us with his enthusiasm to carry the message to the alcoholic who needs help. We considered only one person at that time, and there was no second choice. That person is with us here tonight. Father Martin, the stage is yours.
Here because we're not all there. I am an alcoholic, and if you saw that film and did not guess it, you still need a little attention. You know my name, and that is secondary to the fact that I am an alcoholic. My name I can change. My alcoholism is a fact that will last with me until death. And my entire life and all that I am revolves around it. So it is much more important than my name. Some years ago, I was privileged to give a talk at a meeting in Charleston. And when it was over, the group gave me a little wooden plaque. And the message on it was so frighteningly powerful. I have it hanging in my home now. It said, "Be careful what you do or say. You may be the only big book someone will ever read." Ladies and gentlemen, for the next hour or so, I will be playing with your lives. What is even more important to me than that fact is that when I'm out there and any of you are up here, you will be playing with mine. So be careful what you do or say at AA meetings. We are not here to entertain each other. I love humorous speakers. I'd rather have a good talk than a boring one, but that's relatively unimportant. The Camel cigarette people some years ago used to have an ad, "If you want a treat instead of a treatment, smoke Camels." I reversed that for my AA. I come for a treatment, not a treat. And that's what we're doing here now. I have reached an age in my life where I have come to realize that when I get too old to learn, I will have become too old. There are two people in my life right now. One is a man. He's a 37-year-old grandfather, sober, exactly 12 years last month. My dearest friend, Stu. The other is a woman. Her name is May. She is the mother of the family with whom I live and make my home. They love me so much that everything they say to me, by way of suggestion, correction, and sometimes even reprimand, I know that they love me so much that they speak only for my good, that I be better tomorrow than I am now. And if anyone speaks to me that way, I'll do two things. I will thank you for it, and I will act on it. Now, I'm mentioning that right at the beginning of this talk because I would like to share with you some convictions I have picked up over the past 19 years that I've spent in this fellowship. Some of the things that I say may cause pain, but that's not the purpose for which I say them. I am asking you to believe that I love AA just as much as you do, and everything that I say is given from that motive. I want AA to be better tomorrow than it is today. That's the way I was raised in my own early days in AA. Bill Wilson's favorite slogan, you can go into rehab centers and find all kinds of goofy banners and sayings and everything else. Bill Wilson's favorite slogan, the good is too often the enemy of the best. And too often we're willing to settle for the good enough when the best is available. I don't know about you, but I know about me. I will have the best. Life is too short, and my life is better than half over. And what's left of it, I want the best. And if you don't have it, get out of my way. I'll go right around you to someone who does. And before I begin this evening, I would like to share with you something that came to me from a friend of mine in St. Louis, Joe Golden. I was just reading a letter from him this afternoon in the hotel room. He told me, he was driving me to the airport one morning after an AA thing like this, and he said, I'd like to tell you something that happened to me in Chicago. He had gone to the central office to find out where some meetings were, and he said a lovely black girl there promised to take him to a meeting that night. So he met her, and he said she was quite agitated, very, very upset, and of course instinctively he said, what's wrong? She said, well, I promised to take you to a meeting. And he said, and? She said, I have a brand new girl I'm working with, and she is so upset, she insists on seeing me right now. Joe said, no problem, let's go see her. I don't have to go to a meeting right now. Let's go see this girl. So they met her in a very cheap bar on the south side of the city. And he said, this was a picture. Here's a little girl, 23 years old, black, sober 3 months. And this was her background. From her earliest recollection, all she could remember of her own life was that she had functioned as a whore and a prostitute on the streets in order to survive, and she drank to do it. Her problem? She is sober now, and she can't stand it. But being made to feel like dirt all her life, and feeling guilty herself about herself, she was so afraid of God, she said, there is none, so let's hear no God talk. And her sponsor said, it's all I know to talk about. That's what AA is based on. She said, I don't want to hear it. And this went round and round and round, and they were growing apart. The sponsor couldn't touch her. And Joe could see the sponsor's absolute agitation. She was losing this girl. So Joe let it go till the end, till they both ran out of gas. And he knew that there was something in that kid that had to come out. And when the two of them sat there in silence, he looked at that girl and said, what do you want out of it for? It's the only life you know. He said, she came firing up out of that chair and said, because I'm worth too much. God, she knew that. Ladies and gentlemen, what are you worth? You know what I tell kids in high school when I talk about alcohol? If you think you're a garbage can, you'll treat yourself that way. Now, what kind of sobriety do you think you're worth? My friends, there are all kinds of sobriety available. I know this sounds judgmental, and it is. I know some sober pigs, and so do you. Now, just what kind of sobriety do you want? As I said, I want the best. You know the principle I function under now that I'm sober? Margarine covers the bread, but it ain't butter. And I'm going to shoot for the best. But you know what I learned very early in my own treatment? The best has a pretty good price tag attached. You pay for it. And you get nothing for nothing in this life, and damn little for 2 cents. If you want the best, you pay the price. I made up my mind many years ago that when I speak at an AA meeting, I say nothing without a purpose. And that prevents a whole lot of rambling and padding and absolute nonsense. We learn from each other in this program. We even learn how to tell our stories. And I am afraid that in some areas, speakers' meetings have kind of degenerated slightly into a kind of a can you top this sort of thing, trying to top each other with gigantic drinking bouts. That's not the purpose of AA meetings at all. You remember when Bill and Dr. Bob sat opposite each other at the first AA meeting? Two men utterly poverty-stricken. They weren't interested in writing a handbook of monastic spirituality. They were interested in learning how to survive. Bill had a lifetime of drinking and exactly 6 months of sobriety, and poor old Dr. Bob had a lifetime of drinking and about 6 minutes of sobriety. So they didn't have much. They knew that something was wrong with their drinking, that they drank differently from other people. And Bill said, I wonder if something isn't wrong in us. My friends, at an AA meeting some years ago, I heard a man give one of the most perfect definitions of alcoholism I ever heard. He said, my filter's busted. When I drink differently from other people. And it makes as much sense to me as anything I've ever heard. But old Bill looked at poor Dr. Bob. He said, my friend, I have nothing to offer you except the sum total of my life experience, and I'm willing to share that with you. That's what AA meetings are all about. And so he dumped all of the drinking and a little bit of sobriety, and Dr. Bob did the same. So in the early days of AA, there was much more talk about sickness than there was about being well, but that's not true today. And these two men were very wise when they wrote the big book, along with the help of other early AAers. They laid down guidelines for how to tell our stories. Our stories should disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. Taking people's inventory is one of my favorite indoor sports. I'm good at it. I sit at meetings and I listen to speakers and I clock the amount of times they dedicate to their sick years and the amount of time they dedicate to their AA years, and I have a pretty good indication of their present condition. Is the drinking story unimportant? No, it's all important. The only thing I beg you is when you're up here and I'm out there, don't just tell me how sick you got. Tell me how well you're getting, because that's why I'm here. Tell me how well you're getting. So tonight I will tell you just enough about my drinking to let you know I belong here and to let me know I belong here. So if all you people showed up tonight to hear the lurid details of the drinking priest's past, you may as well go home. I just wasn't that good at being that bad. I don't believe half of you were either. I firmly believe, my friends, that there are very few priests in the audience, but if I tell my story as Bill intended it to be told, I believe every alcoholic in this room can identify with me. Because if I tell my story right, it should indicate two things. When I drank alcohol, I didn't control it. It controlled me. Number two, it caused problems. If I could control my intake without problems, I'd be drinking, and so would you. I believe that an alcoholic is someone whose drinking makes trouble because what makes trouble is trouble. I use one single solitary question to diagnose the disease. Do normal drinkers do this? If your answer is no, you're talking about abnormality. It is that simple. Look at the major problems of your life. Has the bottle been in the picture before, during, or after? If your answer is yes, sign up. So there are a couple of little teensy-weensy key questions to ask to find out whether or not you belong here. Number one, did you ever lie about your drinking? You see, normal drinkers have no reason to lie. I didn't lie much about my drinking. I wasn't asked very much about my drinking. However, I remember one beautiful case. A superior called me in. He said, "Have you been drinking?" I said, "No, Father." Now, I knew I was lying, and he knew I was lying. I knew he knew I was lying. And I lied. My friends, do you know why we alcoholics went through that degrading business of lying to people who knew the truth? If I tell you the truth about my drinking, you're going to tell me to quit, and I know I can't. I know that alcohol is essential to living, and I will do anything to protect it. That's why we lied. Have you ever had your drinking discussed by others? Just answer this. It's real easy. Have you and your wife or husband and three or four other couples ever sat around on a Saturday afternoon and seriously talked about somebody else's intake of sliced tomatoes? You see what I'm doing, don't you? I'm strangling the daylights out of the obvious. People don't talk about our drinking unless there is a drinking problem. It's the classic textbook case, where there's smoke, there's fire. And you know what? Earth-shattering problem absolutely paralyzed us gigantic intellects when we were drinking. Listen, somebody said, we alcoholics are a cut above average intellectually. I always say, there's damn many of us, there's bound to be a brain somewhere. But probably the most horrendous obstacle that we faced in life when we were drinking, how to get rid of empty bottles, means absolutely nothing to a normal person. A little kid will look at you and say, throw them out. Oh, it's too simple. Yeah. When I was first ordained, they sent me to Mountain View, California. I had a lovely walk-in closet in the quarters out there. They were beautiful quarters, in which I had two suitcases, and I saved them to save empties. And between them, they held somewhere between 40 and 50 empty fifth bottles. And when the two suitcases became full, I emptied them. Now, we were out in the orchard country down there in Santa Clara Valley. We had our own dump behind one of the old barns back there. So I was smart. I waited till the kids were in class. And I'd take my two suitcases, and I'd head out the side of the building, down past all the athletic facilities and the ball fields out behind the barn. Never occurred to me that all I had to do was look out the window. What they would have seen was Mrs. Martin's little boy, dressed in a long, flowing black cassock, carrying two suitcases, heading into the hills. It never occurred to me they might have thought that to be slightly weird. But anyway, I would reach the haven of refuge down there, the lovely dump, and I would bury these dead soldiers one at a time, consoled by the fact that every one of those dead soldiers had a priest with him when he died. Ladies and gentlemen, that is about the only funny thing that I know to tell you about my drinking. Very shortly thereafter, I only drank for 10 years, and 5 were rather trouble-free. The rest were rather slowly progressive. But little things like this, I was hospitalized in April one year, St. Mary's Hospital in San Francisco, and the afternoon I left to go, I cut myself shaving, which is not unusual. I do that daily. I was using an electric razor at the time. Try that. I came out and started to drink again, and they put me on an airplane to fly me east. What is so significant about that? Number one, I was a teacher. I taught school for 21 years in seminary work. And this was April in a school year. Three priests had to pick up my courses and give final exams. This does not happen to normal drinkers. I was reassigned to St. Charles College on the East Coast. My friends, I have never, never been transferred the length of a nation because of trouble with French fried potatoes. Alcohol. Look at the problems of your life. Has the bottle been in the picture before, during, or after? If your answer is yes, this is where we belong. If you get no answers from those questions, try this one. How many of you made AA for good behavior? How many of you gals got into the program for being wife of the year? I went back to Baltimore and spent the two most horrible, frustrated years of my life. Ladies and gentlemen, this has happened to every alcoholic in this room. I tried to quit drinking and could not. And the quiet terror begins to take over your soul. You know something's wrong. You vaguely know that it has to do with alcohol, but you don't want to believe that. Because alcohol is your dearest friend, because the only thing that alleviates the terror is more of the drug that's creating it. The vicious, vicious circle of compulsive drinking. The nameless fear. God. You lie on your back, staring at the ceiling, shaking to pieces, when there's a knock at the door, when the phone rings. This does not happen to normal people. I was asked one day to give her first communion to one of my nieces. She was in the second grade. I was privileged to have presided at her wedding last August, but I was too sick to go over there for that mass that morning. And they were kind enough not to say anything. My favorite sister invited me out of her home. Ladies and gentlemen, I have only been physically drunk about 6 or 7 times in my life. I have been drunk less than many social drinkers I know. But they knew something was wrong with my drinking, and she said, please don't come back until your self-respect returns. I was invited out of a parish where I was helping out on Sundays. My friends, that's enough. When your drinking makes trouble, it is. And my drinking made trouble in my life. My superior called me in one day with tears in his eyes. He said, what do you want? Name it. If it's obtainable, it is yours, if it'll help you to stop drinking. And then he said something that chilled my blood. He said, something will have to be done and soon, or you cannot continue to do seminary work. It is one thing to read about despair on the pages of a theology textbook, and it's another to realize it in the guts of your soul. And then this gentle man, he was sickly most of his life. He died the way Pope Pius XII died. He hiccuped to death. The man wore out. He couldn't sleep. He simply wore out. But a few years before he did, he called me on the phone and said, I would like to see you. And I shook to pieces for 2 days, wondering, what have I done now? But he came one afternoon and said, we are sending you away this summer. For those of you who have asked me, how do you confront an alcoholic? He, without any knowledge, he had no intellectual knowledge of alcoholism at all. He believed it was a symptom of an underlying cause and sent me to a psychiatrist to find out what it was. But he had the understanding of the human heart. He simply knew that one of his sons was suffering and he wanted him to get well. And he made a statement, we are sending you away this summer to get well. He said, now this is not punitive. We want you to get well. I've been waiting for 2 years to hear that. Don't hand me this garbage that you don't help an alcoholic unless and until he asks for it. God in heaven, my friend, you'll go to a funeral first. Out of this side of my mouth, I say it's a disease of body, mind, emotion, and soul. And out of this side of my mouth, I say I'm not going to help him until he makes a rational decision with that sick mind. How many of you busted out of bed on a lovely summer morning and said, gee, it's a great day, I think I'll go to AA. You don't do that. How many of you got up in a lovely summer day and went next door and rang the doorbell and said, hi there, can you help me with my drinking? We don't do that. We have to be forced to get well. That's part of the disease. So I entered a place called Guest House in Lake Orion, Michigan, which was founded by a layman. It is very significant that a layman carried the two beams that made the cross Christ died on up the hill for him. And it is so significant that the lives of the alcoholic priests are saved by lay people. I would like to tell you now what happened to me at Guest House and what they did to get me well. I would share some convictions with you this evening. If you can use them, great. If you don't agree with any of them, just push them aside, but for God's sake, don't argue with me about them. They're mine. And I spent a lot of years getting them from people whose judgments I respect. I entered Guest House on a Sunday afternoon, and I met the man who saved my life. Ladies and gentlemen, the first absolute conviction is the utter necessity of a good sponsor. It absolutely appalls me when I hear people who came into AA grasping for help like a drowning man who now feel self-sufficient enough to go along without a sponsor. I don't understand it. Bill Wilson insisted on it. Every spiritual writer insisted on it. No one is judge in his own case. My God, my friends, if I were judging my own case, I wouldn't need you. And I've had enough of being alone. It was not the 12 steps printed on a sheet of paper to save my life. It was a man. His name was Austin Ripley. It was the 12 steps carved in his life that saved mine. The tradition says that we place principles before personalities. It does not say that we place principles instead of personality. I absolutely shudder when I hear people say in AA, they walk alone again.
Well, AA is no popularity contest. I don't care what people think of me.
I do. And I care a great deal what good, solid people think of me. Because if they think ill of me, I'm off track. Did you ever hear that marvelous story about the couple went to West Point to see their kid graduate? The Corps came marching by in review, and as they did, the mother turned to the father and said, Henry, isn't that marvelous? There are 4,000 cadets out there. Our little Georgie is the only one in step. Ladies and gentlemen, that's why we have each other as guides. If the whole world is out of step but me, I'm out of step. I wasn't in that man's presence 10 minutes, and I wanted to be exactly like him. I wanted everything he had. And for those two reasons, I would have died to please him. Had he told me that it was essential for me to sleep on the floor, I would have done it without question. Without question. And if you don't have anybody like that in your life, I feel sorry for you. I really do. My friends, I hope to the good God that up until the day I die, I will be a hero worshiper. And if you don't have a hero, you better get one. The power of example gets us sober. People save the lives of people. And that's why it sounds so insane when a brand new person comes in, he's having trouble with a higher power, someone says, take that coffee cup over there. God. People who say that never get up at their own anniversaries and say, hi guys, meet my sponsor. you ever get down on your knees and pray to a coffee cup for sobriety? I don't believe that. I really don't. They say down in Texas is
take that fence post over there. You know what dogs do to fence posts.
I don't know about you, but I do not belong to Coffee Cups Anonymous. I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. My friends, people get people sober. People get people sober. That's why they say come back to meetings. Because if I didn't need people, I could get sober in my, you know, back in the kitchen cabinet, right? Anyway, Rip told me, he said, hey, Father, if you want to get well, you have to admit you're sick. I said, oh, that kind of makes sense. He says, you know, guest house is not a place for people suffering from string bean poisoning. It has to be a place for alcoholics, and you did not get here by mistake. He taught me a whole lot of lovely lessons. Hey, by the way, if why is it that when we have a toothache, without any thought of our degrees, we go to a dentist? We don't think about intellectualizing about pain and decay and everything. We just go to a dentist, say, I got some pain, take care of it. If you have an attack of appendicitis, you immediately go to a surgeon, say, take care of it. We don't put our brains into it. Suddenly, alcoholism, and we think our intellects has something to do with it. Rick gave me the finest lesson I ever learned in my life. He said, hey, Father, I know all about your degrees and your education. He said, your brains didn't work, did they? I said, no. He said, leave them right outside the door. Now, you don't need brains to get sober. You need desire. You need desire. And then he pointed out two marvelous, marvelous lessons. One of them was a lesson in anatomy. He said, when the good Lord made us, he gave us two ears and one mouth. Now, I wonder what he's trying to tell us. And the other one was, you know, the old principle, when all else fails, follow direction. When Bill Wilson wrote the 12 steps, now hold on to your dentures, this is dead serious. When Bill Wilson wrote the 12 steps, he numbered them. You know what he was trying to say? Three goes before four. You don't need a PhD to grasp that. All right, number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. My friends, our greatest strength is in acknowledging our weakness. I cannot handle alcohol, and that's the basis of my recovery, is an acknowledgement and a total surrender to that fact. Powerless is an absolute term. There are no ifs, ands, and buts, no adjectives, no adverbs, no nothing. I've heard people in AA say, after they got well, they don't like to use the word fear, so they say, I'm not afraid of alcohol, I respect it. Be my guest, I don't. Bill said that we should lose our unreasonable fears, but I think there are a whole lot of perfectly sane fears. I think that any human being who is not afraid of fire is a fool. And if a man with a machine gun came in here and started firing it off, I'd create a brand new door right up there. And I don't think I'd be crazy to try to do that. My friends, I hope I go to my grave fearing that drinking alcohol will kill me, because the day I lose that fear, I'm going to try drinking. I do not respect alcohol. Never did, never will. To me, respect means to look up to. I respect people, I respect principles, but I cannot respect a chemical that nearly killed me. Step one is the base of the pyramid of the rest of your life. It is the base on which that pyramid is to be built. I believe with a passion that the depth and the seriousness with which we work the rest of this program depends directly on the depth and the seriousness with which we accept step one. To me, step one is not something I take and then go on. Step one is an ever-present, everlasting acknowledgement and awareness of my condition. I am an alcoholic. You tell me you're alcoholics, I believe you. I've never seen a one of you with a glass in your hand. All I know is that I'm one. And my life depends on that statement. And I every day of my life, I just deepen that awareness. Step one, rather briefly, says, give in or you'll cave in. Well, what are we going to do about it? It's kind of a negative thing. And yet it is not negative. It is my strength. A moron knows how strong he is. A genius knows how weak he is. Joe Louis was defeated once in his prime by Max Schmeling. And when the fight was over, Schmeling told how he did it. He said, I watched movies, and he said, I found one flaw in Joe Louis's armor. And he picked away at it and knocked him out. He found Joe Louis's weakness. Now, this was Schmeling's weakness. He published that, and Joe Louis read it. Of course, the next fight's history. Step two, I entered a room and looked at sober alcoholics and came to believe that I could get well. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Ladies and gentlemen, I met Bill Wilson once, only once, and I heard him talk, and he explained what he meant by the insanity of alcoholism. I have heard whole meetings, not wasted, but taking a wrong turn, with people getting up and talking about the nutty things they did when they were drunk. That has nothing to do with it. Has nothing to do with it. Non-alcoholics do nutty things when they drug themselves. He wasn't talking about that at all. The insanity of the alcoholic is when he's physically sober and picks up the first drink of the next series. It is irrational or insane behavior to consume a chemical that is killing you. Now, in order not to do that, we have to have the desire to do it removed. But when you and I were drinking, we were like men and women who climbed into a boxing ring with a champion every day and got beat up. Next day, ran again. Boom. Next day, boom. Next day, boom. 16 and a half years later, we're black and blue, we're crawling on our hands and knees, heading for the ring. Guess what's going on in this PhD brain? I wonder how I cannot get beat up today. AA leans over your shoulder and says, don't get in the ring. Too simple. But AA gives us the formula for sobriety. If you don't take a drink, you cannot get drunk. That's the name of the game of life for the suffering alcoholic. Don't drink. But it's impossible, so AA says. Can you not drink just today? And most of us rise to the occasion. Yes, I think I can do it for a day. Now, what motivates me to do it? Looking at others who have done it before me. So the night after I came to Guest House, I went to my first AA meeting, the West Side Group in Pontiac, Michigan. And there were about 26 sober people there. And every one of them said, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic. And yet every one of them said, I got 22 years, I got 15 years, I have 11 years, I have 9 years, I have 18 years. And I'm looking at them and say, hey, wait a minute, you're an alcoholic, right? Yes, you took the first step, right? You are powerless over alcohol, right? The power to not drink is not in you, right? Yeah, I said, where'd you get it? Where did you get the strength to not drink? They said, if it ain't in, it's out. We reached outside of ourselves to a power greater than self. And it made sense. Ladies and gentlemen, I am not here as a priest trying to cram Catholic theology down your throats, but I would like to share with you a few notions that I've learned about the higher power in AA. I believe that the job of the higher power is to do two things. To give us the strength to not drink, and then the means to exercise that strength. And I came to believe that this could be done by looking at it. I'm looking now at sober alcoholics. And if you reached outside of yourself to something beyond and above you, I came to believe that that could happen to me. And so I was told to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God as we understood him. I think that God gives us the power to not drink and the power and the means to use that power. Now in AA we have lots of lovely slogans, and one of the big ones is let go and let God. And I'm not too sure that that we really know what that means. Take me with my background. Supposing at my very first AA meeting, I came in and somebody said, hey, buddy, you having trouble with your drinking? Yes. Let go and let God. I would have done that. I would have let go completely and quit trying. Said, okay, God, I'm letting you. Make me sober. But he doesn't work that way. He gave me the strength, like a physician gives a prescription, but it's up to me to get it filled and take the medicine. Well, I'm not thinking about get out of the driver's seat and let God take over. Don't do that. You have a wreck. You will. You have a wreck. God does not come down and take over the driver's seats of our lives. You know what God gives drivers? Maps. We do the driving. But you know what most of us do with maps? Shove them in a glove compartment, step on the accelerator. 4 hours later, we're in the woods. How did I get here? So I get the Mac out, dum-dum, and look at that. That's the way God's not about it. Did he ever get breakfast for you? Ever pay the rent? Because I ain't got no idea where we could be. But hold on for the good of news. Announcement number two. We're making a damn good time. Absolutely magnificent, almost photographic picture of the alcoholic. The alcoholic hasn't the foggiest notion where he's going, but he's getting there quick. We get sober. We get the drug out of the system. The I becomes, you know, begins to get back over the E. Intellect is now beginning to predominate. Now we're asked to use it. We now begin to do what most normal, mature people have been doing all their lives. Prepare and then execute. We admit we're sick. We accept a prescription to get well. We enter a room and look at sober people. We come to believe that we can get that way. We make a decision to turn our lives over to God. We spend each day doing it. We take an inventory. We make it known. We become willing to have our defects removed. We ask to have them wiped out. We make a list and become willing to make amends, and then we do it. Prepare and then execute. Prepare and execute. What's the purpose of an inventory? The purpose of any inventory shows you what you got, what you haven't got, and what has to go. I feel very strongly about what I'm about to say now. AA demands, as they say, rigorous honesty. Obviously, that has to do about our drinking, when we must admit we have trouble with it in order to get into AA, for starters. But once we're in AA, it demands honesty in every other aspect of our lives. And where a lot of us, especially me, have trouble is with this whole business of humility. We talk it to death. Humility is truth. It is not denying the talent God gave you. I've got plenty of talent, so do you. And yet people try to deny it under the guise of, it's a kind of a phony humility. I remember, and this is not funny, ladies and gentlemen, it is not funny, but I once heard a speaker at an AA meeting say, when I was drinking, I was a drunken SOB, and now, he said, I'm sober 14 years. Well, I haven't done much, and I don't have much to show for it, but at least I'm a sober SOB. Everybody laughed. If ever you hear that come out of somebody's lips, just go up to them and say, you know, I too have noticed your lack of progress. ladies and gentlemen, we're not here for garbage like that. If after 14 years, the only thing you can show me is you haven't been drinking, either something's wrong with the program or something's wrong with you, and I know nothing's wrong with this program. Please don't waste my time. God grant me the serenity to accept the gifts and the talents that I have, acknowledging where they come from and what they're to be used for. The courage to do that and the wisdom to know how. My friends, God never made a nothing. You know what I believe? I can't prove this, but I believe it. I believe that every one of us in this room has a talent that nobody else has. And I also believe this. We're going to be asked to use it someday to touch another human heart that nobody else will be able to touch. So you better find out what your talent is. You're going to be asked to use it someday. You know what the frightening responsibility of the recovered alcoholic is? My friends, you know this as well as I do. For every one of us in this room, well, there are going to be about 5 or 6 or 10 or 20. Pick your statistic. Let's just say 10. There are going to be 10 alcoholics who will die without ever recovering in AA. What right have we to be here? Absolutely none. We're not meant to joke and play around with the talents that God gave us. We've got talent. We also have certain things, certain deprivations, certain needs, certain not-haves that other people do. But most of us spend our lives being envious of the talents of others. And here's where the big mistake is made. Hey, looks at us like a loving mother and says, hey, did you ever stop and think that maybe you have an inferiority complex because you're inferior? Every one of you in this room has something that I don't have. And that's the beauty of human existence. Today I'm going to use your strength, and tomorrow you're going to have to use mine. It's awfully embarrassing to watch the no talent who thinks he's got it. A few years ago, I used to have Walter Mitty dreams, you know, in the days of the Baltimore Colts greatness, you know, Johnny Unitas and Raymond Berry and Gino Marchetti and that crowd. I used to always daydream that one day on a blustery, foggy, snowy, bitter cold December Sunday afternoon, the Colts would be playing the Green Bay Packers 30 seconds to go, and they're losing by 3 points, and Unitas gets hurt. You've got the picture. I'm way up in the stands, way, way up in the top. Poor old John gets clobbered, and they carry him off the field, and Don Shula is absolutely frantic. And he turns around and he scans the stands. He has all of his coaches looking up there till he spots me. He waves me down, and I run out on the field without a helmet. And I throw the bomb from my own 28-yard line into the end zone. Barry catches it, touchdown. They carry me around the city for the next 8 months. Never happened. He never did that. You know what AA has taught me? If I practice throwing footballs 1,000 a day for 1,000 years, I still won't be able to throw him as well as John Unitas if he lives to be 180. But it doesn't bother me, because there are a few things I can do that he can't. And I'm going to make my way to the grave by doing the things that I do well. And I'll let him throw football. And then we find out what has to go. Now, my friends, we come to step 5. The step that separates the men from the boys and the big girls from the little girls. We admitted to God, well, that's easy, he knows. To ourselves, that's a little tough. But to one other human being, the exact nature of our wrong. My friend, just picture this in your own mind's eye. Who of you in this room, includes me, who of us would want any given 24-hour period of our lives shown on a screen to the rest of us? Every thought, I wouldn't want you to see my best day. And that's why step 5 says, one other human being. I've heard people water that down. Let me share this with you, I think it's important. Jim Gracie was a dear friend of mine in AA, he's dead. One night we were discussing steps 4 and 5 at an AA meeting, and a fellow said, I figure it's what I bear at these meetings, at these tables, that constitutes my 5th step. And Jim Gracie, God bless him, he said, I figure that it's what I don't dare say at these tables that constitutes mine. Once we take the big 5th step, it is only then that we will appreciate its value. You cannot reason to it, you have to do it. And then anyone can say, my past is discharged, my present is secure, and my future is assured, all other things being equal. You know what Rip told me at guest house? He said, Father, after I took my 5th step, he was a writer, and he lived in hotels all over the country. He said, I could go into any given hotel in the United States and have some guy come out from behind a potted palm and say, Ripley, you're an SOB. And he said I could look him in the eye and say, I used to be. I used to be. And now comes what for me, after 19 years, is the most difficult part of AA. The deliberate self-discipline involved in steps 6 and 7 that demand growth. Real freedom is not doing your own thing. If I were to do my own thing, I'd wind up in jail. So would most of you. Real freedom means being free from the things that make me selfish so that I'm open enough to go out and love you. Step 6, we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. Now, my defects have character. I don't know about you. Step 7, we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. Somebody once said, if you don't want him removed, don't ask, because if you ask, he'll try. Now, please, this is not a lesson in spirituality. It's just something that I'm still learning. I'd like to pass on to you what I feel about these 2 steps. Step 6 is extremely difficult for me because I'm too attached to some of my shortcomings. I don't want them yet removed. And that's frightening. That is frightening. Because my defects keep me shackled to me. The only way I know how to become ready to have God remove my defects of character is just pray for it. And I'm not even sure I want to, for some of them. You know what I've learned in life? From my alcoholism, I learned that God does 2 things. He did not just remove my alcoholism. I had to do the steps, not God. But that's the way he removed my desire to drink. He does exactly the same thing for my other defects of character. He just doesn't remove them. He gives me the strength to do it myself, and then he gives me the opportunity to exercise that strength. What I'm talking about is this. Ever you're at an AA meeting, and it's 10 minutes before starting time, and about 3 minutes before starting time, some guy runs in, and he's really upset. Really upset. What a day. What a day. I never needed a meeting so bad in my life. I was late starting out. I had a flat. While I'm fishing it, somebody totaled my car. I'm late getting into work. I had a fight with a secretary. The boss called me out for missing 3 customers. I'm late coming home, so she burned a dinner. We had a Donnybrook in front of the kids. I cut myself shaving, burned myself in the shower, and I just about made it to the meeting. Worst day of my life. Some old pro in the back of the room says, it sounds to me like God offered you 28 opportunities to grow, and you blew them all. I tell people, this is perfectly true. I do not go anywhere near counseling. I am not good one-on-one, except maybe at an initial interview. I am too impatient to be a good counselor, so I don't even try it. I'll help you get well if you show me you already are. That's the way I was born. So God sees to it that I don't screw up too many individual lives. He just gives me whole crowds. But anyway, if you're like me, I think that every human being is plagued at one time or another with impatience. All our lives, if you're like me, when I think of it, dear Lord, please make me a little bit more patient. And somehow or other, I think he's going to do it. But he didn't do that with my alcoholism. He said, here are the tools. You do it. Faith moves mountains, but bring a shovel, is what he said. The value of prayer is great. I'm not underestimating the power of prayer, please, ladies and gentlemen, because it is prayer that gets that strength from God. But there's a lot of things that prayer does not do. For example, I do not have a right to miracles, and I don't know why I pray for them. I believe this quite strongly. I'm not joking at all. I believe that if I were to pray tonight to be made a doctor by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, God could. But I don't believe he would. Dear Lord, please make me a doctor. And the answer would be, fine. Go to med school. I mean, you know, I know that sounds like kindergarten stuff, but it's absolutely true. God wants us to take the natural means to the end. Isn't it true that if we prayed hard enough, God might waft us home into our beds after this meeting? I don't believe he will. I think he wants you to drive the way you came. I mean that. That's, to me, the spiritual way. Now, how does he remove my defects of character? In a very natural way. If I'm impatient, he's going to give me opportunities to exercise patience. And I usually miss them. I pick up maybe on about 3 out of every 20 opportunities that God gives me. And the reason I don't pick up on the others is the opportunities are usually painful. Pain, my friends, is the true fertilizer of maturity. We cannot grow without pain. But there's only one thing wrong with it. It hurts. Pain hurts. All right, here we are praying for patience. Age 24. We've just mouthed off and caused harm and caused people to weep and so on. And we're sorry, so, you know, hey, dear Lord, please make me a little bit more patient. Age 38. All right, Lord, you can start. Age 46. Are you listening? Age 59. It's getting late. Age 72. All right, Lord, please. And he's up there saying, I'm trying, I'm trying. He's giving us all kinds of opportunity. We're messing up. How do we go about growing and deliberately using discipline to grow with? My friends, discipline becomes more and more difficult as we grow older. That's the paradox of life. The easiest thing to acquire is a bad habit. The toughest is a good one. The bad ones hang on and the good ones disappear even, you know, without our recognizing they're gone. I'll tell you how I try sometimes to exercise self-discipline. And I don't know about you, but this is the way I sit at discussion meetings. First of all, I get off to a good start when some fellow who knows that he's had to chair this meeting for about a month and a half comes in and says, well, I don't have any topic, let's just kick it around. Well, I'd like to kick him around. I truly believe, my friends, that when God gives us our reasoning back, it's meant to be used. Hey, by the way, you want to have a dandy discussion meeting? The next time you are asked to chair a discussion meeting, just say, my friends, my name is so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. For tonight's topic, what should a good chairman be and do at an AA meeting? You'll be amazed at everything that comes out. You are playing with my life, and when you are chairing an AA meeting, you have a responsibility to me. And if you don't want to exercise, get somebody else to chair. I've heard all this stuff about there. You know, there's no such thing as a bad AA meeting. Maybe they're not bad, but I've been to some pretty lousy ones. I really have, and I think they could have been infinite. The good is too often the enemy of the best. That's what Bill Wilson held up to it. Shoot for the stars. That's why he put them there. Here's the way I sit at a discussion meeting. Guy comes in, my name's so-and-so, the topic is humility. And then he gives a lovely introductory paragraph so that we can hang a few of our thoughts on. And he begins going around the room. Hey, John, how about you? You got any thoughts on humility? And poor old John, it's the broken record. He's sober 487 years, and he says the same words every night. My name's John, I'm an alcoholic. I took my first drink when I was 2 and a half, and I puked all over my mother, and she hit me in the head with a kitchen cabinet. And this goes on. And after 18 minutes, he hadn't said a word about humility. Hey, Mary, you got anything to say about humility? Well, that doughead I'm married to, what a day we... And 20 minutes later, she hadn't said anything about humility. Now, this is me on the other side of the room. I'm mentally drumming my fingers because somebody saw me drumming my real fingers and told me to quit. But this is what's going on up here. Wait till it gets to me, I'm going to straighten this whole thing out. Did you do that? Well, these knotheads don't even know what it's all about, but when it gets to me, I'm going to spell it out A, B, C. In fact, Jesus, if there's a blackboard there, I have to use this. You know. Or, all right. So it comes to me, and I said, my name's Father Martin, I'm an alcoholic, and I've passed. It's like cutting your tongue off, you know. It took a lot of years, but you know what I've learned in AA? If I were to die tomorrow, I hope to God there would be a few tears shed. I mean that. But by next week, I would be a memory. Just a memory. A pleasant one, I hope, but a memory. And your lives would go on, and my family's lives would go on, because they have their problems and you have yours. Ladies and gentlemen, what I leave behind me is not a whole lot of words that straightened out AA me. Every one of us is the sum total of the todays that made up his life. AA does not consist in what we snow each other with at these meetings. It consists in what we live in between them. It is not talking the talk, it's walking the walk. And I can leave a meeting like that, and I'd be the only one on earth that knows what giant therapy has come my way by that refusal to talk. Walking the walk is the name of the game. Can you put your money where your mouth is? Making amends? I've heard people say, well, I figure just staying sober is making amends. No, it ain't. Staying sober is staying sober. Making amends is making amends. Get a dictionary, friend. It's the only thing that nobody else can do for us now. You don't get the wife to pick up the phone and call the boss. You don't get the kids to lie for you. Now we have to do things on our own. We make the amends. I remember one time I bawled a kid out in class and made him cry. That had never happened in 21 years of teaching. I was sober then when it happened. And he's a beautiful psychologist today, and he's a counselor and a good one. But I remember this kid was in second year high school, and he cried. And I went upstairs, and I looked up the answer he had given, and good God, he was right. So I picked the telephone up and asked one of the priests to get him out of the study hall so I could apologize to him. And then it dawned on me, I bawled that kid out in class in front of his classmates, and that's where he would have his apology. I've heard this in AA, oh, make the amend, it'll make you feel good. Ladies and gentlemen, we don't make amends because it'll make us feel good. We make them because they ought to be made. Because some amends you make won't make you feel good. You may apologize to 20 people and make them cry. And they'll say, that's all right, we're just glad you're sober. But this happened to Austin Ripley one time. He wrote for Look magazine, and he went back to the Look building in New York. And he was apologizing to everybody. He said, I owed apologies to everybody, from the president to the guy that opens the front door. And he hit the middle of the building, and the man made him wait. When he was ushered into the fellow's office, the fellow did not invite him to sit. He said, what do you want, Ripley? And Rip went into his speech that could make a stone weep. When he was finished, the man said, you were an SOB then and you're one now. Get out of my office. And Rip was hurt and he was angry. And he ran to the elevator, pressed the button. He wanted to go to the airport, fly back to Chicago. And then it dawned on him, that man didn't have to accept my apology. I had to give it. And for those of you who want, you know, in some circles in AA, they say, do what makes you feel good. Well, boy, if that's not handing a machine gun to a hitman, I don't know what is. That's ridiculous. I know men who want to feel good, take their fifth step to their wives, and absolutely destroy another human being. What right have we to do that? Do you know some of the pain that many of us are going to have to carry to our graves is keeping some things to ourselves and bearing it to someone else rather than the wife or the husband? Some people are told things that they should never hear, and this, my friends, is the value of a sponsor. No matter what you've done, no matter what amend you have to make, someone's always made it before you. For God's sake, find out how to go about these things. Don't destroy people under the guise of being honest. You simply need the guidance of a good, wise sponsor to do certain things in AA. Step 10, we continue to take inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it so that there would be no backup of guilt.
You know why we take steps 4 and 5? We cannot stand sober what we built up when we were drinking. And so we're asked to get rid of it or it'll destroy us. Unresolved remorse will kill you. That's why step 5 is there. Step 11, prayer. I used to spend a lot of time on this step because a lot of people are afraid of it, and I used to try to dispel the fear. Ladies and gentlemen, in a sentence, do you know why you ought to pray? It's only fitting. If you really need someone to explain to you why you ought to have a personal relationship with the God who gave you the gift of sobriety, or even the person on earth can explain it. It's only fitting to have a relationship with the God of your understanding who gave you the priceless gift of sobriety. But a few things about prayer. Did you ever notice when we were drinking, nobody knew anything about anything? We're 3 weeks sober and we're all spiritual experts.
Well, you know, before I used to say them little prayers that my mother taught me, but I dropped that. Me and God are buddies now. We just talk.
Well, that is great. I'm not knocking that. But did it ever occur to you that we might be talking him to death? Do you ever wonder what a Sunday morning is like in heaven? All I can see is the dear Lord looking for a closet. Here they come again. I honestly believe that some of the prayers we pray over each other are for our own benefit. We're trying to impress each other. I promised Lou it would be a very brief grace before meals. It bless the food and eat. People get up and give speeches, you know, and the Lord's up there saying the beans are getting cold. Spirituality is a very blunt, plain love affair with God. And you know the true language of love? It's a beautiful Latin expression, cor ad cor loquitur, heart speaks to heart. One of the loveliest things I ever heard, and I'm sure it's a myth, it's just a story. There was an old illiterate Italian stonemason. He'd get up at 5 a.m, go to work, and lift rocks and cut them and put them together every day of his life, did it all his life. And every afternoon of his life at 4:30 on the way home, he used to drop by his parish church and spend an hour in there. And as the years went by, some of his co-workers said, "What do you do in there?" Have any of you had the unfortunate experience of showing up for church on Sunday 5 minutes early? You say every prayer you know, you do all the meditating you can, you got 4.5 minutes left. It's the longest 5 minutes of the week. They said, "What are you doing there for an hour?" And that old man thought for the longest time, and he said this, "I really don't know." He said, "I go in and I sit in a pew and I look at him and he looks at me and we love each other." Do you ever hear people compare this prayer is better than that prayer? Those who say they don't recite memorized prayers will stand up at the end of a meeting and recite the Lord's Prayer. You know why we have memorized prayers? So we can pray together. We have meditation so we can pray alone. It isn't the idea of praying individually or praying together. We have to do both. I'm an individual and I'm a member of society. The same is true in my relationship with God. AA, my friends, is totally embarrassed when people substitute meetings for their religious faith. They really are. Bill Wilson said, "Whatever you were before, you ought to be a better one after you get sober. You ain't sober right yet." AA is horribly embarrassed when we use it. AA is meant to do two things, get us sober and keep us that way. It's not a marriage counselor. It's not a doctor. I tell people, if you ever find me in an accident, for God's sake, get me to an emergency room, not a meeting. I'll just leave you with this. I truly believe that prayer is like meeting. It is not volume, it's consistency that counts. And I also believe that 1 minute a day will not break anyone's back. Step 12 is AA's crowning glory. The family that I live with, the mother, is in AA. She's one of 11 children, 10 of whom are alcoholics.
7 got well, 2 died, 1 is still drinking. Hey, by the way, please keep her sister Grace in your prayers. She fell last night, she has Parkinson's disease, broke her hip, and she will not come out of it. It's one of those horrible breaks that she will simply not survive. She's operated on at noon today. Anyway, May is in AA, and one other of her sisters is in AA. She has a brother who simply went back to his Baptist faith. And I tell people in AA, I know a man who is sober on his own. And the frown. Yeah? You know, nobody dare get sober any different way from us, right? Yeah? Well, how long? 12 years? Oh, and the frown deepens. You know? Sad as hell, somebody's getting well, you know. And then this brilliant statement, well, he can't be happy. He's eminently happy. I'd give anything for his type of serenity. Ladies and gentlemen, do you know the difference between May's AA sobriety and his private sobriety? Simple. When he dies, his sobriety will die with him. And when she dies, she will have touched hundreds of thousands of people that she's never even seen. Bill Wilson was the man who dreamed the impossible dream, and he fought the unbeatable foe. He bore with unbearable sorrow and ran where the brave dared not go. But he knew if he'd only be true to his glorious quest that his heart would lie peaceful and calm when laid to his rest. And the world has been better for this. One man, just one, scorned, covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage. He reached the unreachable star. And he held within the arms of his heart that blinding jewel that men and women for centuries had been looking for. He had it, sobriety. But in the quest, he did everything that changed him completely, and he stood before God and man as a restored human being. And a human being is built in the image of God, and so he acted like God. God, who is goodness. Goodness tends to diffuse itself, and that's exactly what he did. He shared sobriety, and that's why this room is filled right now. Somehow it all began. Dr. Bob did not call Bill Wilson. Bill called him. We are asked to carry the message to the alcoholic. That's what my book says. The fifth tradition was just read. The group has as its one primary purpose to carry the message to the alcoholic who is still suffering. I saw the movie Patton 5 times. I believe Scott was born to play that role. I've seen him in some garbage, but boy, that was his masterpiece. That was a classic. Remember how that movie began? I think it was the first and only time the Anglo-Saxon word found in the dictionary, bastard, was ever used in a movie. But this is the way he used it. It was the night before they were to invade the continent, and he got, I don't know, thousands of his troops in a huge hangar in England. And he said, be seated. And when they sat down, he said this, no bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. We win wars by making some other poor dumb bastard die for his country. And then he gave a brilliant talk on dying and war and killing and bloodshed and everything else. Ladies and gentlemen, that thing hit me like a sledgehammer because I knew that there was something for us alcoholics in those words. I knew it. And after the third time I saw that movie, I was reading the breviary, the priest's prayer book, and one line from one psalm nearly knocked me out of the chair. See what you hear. My neighbors stand afar off because of my affliction. My neighbors stand afar off because of my affliction. The alcoholic. We have become the illegitimized children of humanity because of our affliction, and our neighbors stood afar off. The lepers in the days of Christ were relegated to holes in the hills. They cried from afar, have mercy on them. And that was us alcoholics. We were the bastardized versions of human beings. And the next time I saw Patton, this is what I heard. No alcoholic bastard ever won the war against this disease by dying. We will win this war, you and I, by helping to make some other poor, frustrated alcoholic live. Step 12, my friends, is gratitude in action. It is known as putting your money where your mouth is. My friends, don't talk to me about gratitude. Show me. I know what it is like. We have gotten well. We've come out of the valley of death, and we just talk gratitude all the time. But there are some people who just talk it to death. If you are grateful, you won't have to tell me. I will see it. Definition of gratitude. It is the only coin with which you can buy God. If you're grateful for today's sobriety by carrying a message to the alcoholic, gratitude in action, you just bought tomorrow's sobriety. What's my life like now? 8 summers ago, I lay in the home of Tommy and May Abraham, so sick with depression, I did not want to leave a dark room. My self-confidence was shattered. I had no teaching assignment. My life was upside down. I was using medication started as a result of 2 major surgeries. I had run out of gas and didn't know it until I stepped on the accelerator and nothing gave. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, one beautiful summer afternoon with the shade drawn, I'm lying in bed sobbing. May is sitting on one side and her son Alex sitting on the other. And I said this: I am 45 years old, and all I have to show for it is that damn Chalk Talk. And May said, "Father, please get well, and one day you'll be giving it around the world." And it happened. 2 years later, it was filmed. Somebody once asked me, how do you handle all of the adulation that comes your way? I hope I handle it well, but May usually handles it for me. If it hadn't been for her, I would not be here, you see. My friends, this summer, I will tour the Pacific and a lot of Europe for the United States Air Force, carrying the message that saved our lives. You know what my life is like now? I get to fly airplanes and come to places like this and meet and fall in love with people like you. In my life now is a kind of a minor one, and yet it is almost earth-shattering, really. It is a horrible thing to come into an area and fall in love with the likes of you and then have to leave wondering if I'll ever be back, if I'll ever see you again. But we know that pain really is the fertilizer of true growth. And for that reason, I do not wish you joy without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength and love and wisdom, goods gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. Within a few weeks, I hope to break ground on 50 acres in North Carolina to build a treatment center for alcoholics so that my own philosophy of alcoholism and true sobriety will be, I hope, perpetuated after I leave this vale of tears. Goodbye to you, but this is the hard part of the evening.